Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Welcome and thank you for tuning in. Today we're going to talk to Professor Paul Davies, who is the author of a new book, The Eerie Silence, that describes our so far unsuccessful search for extraterrestrial intelligence and what we might do to broaden our search efforts. Paul Davies is professor at the University of Arizona. He's a theoretical physicist, a cosmologist, and an astrobiologist. Paul is the director of the Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science. He is also chairman of the SETI Post-Detection Task Force. SETI, of course, being the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Paul is also the recipient of the Templeton Prize and the Faraday Prize. Paul is the author of over 20 books, and his latest book, The Eerie Silence, is being published as we speak today. Paul, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Robert, for inviting me on.
Paul, this is the 50th year of our active search for ET. How would you characterize that effort so far?
Well, the title of my book says it all. It has so far been nothing but silence, a somewhat eerie silence. That's not for want of trying. When this project began 50 years ago, the young astronomer Frank Drake was extremely bold in blazing this trail. I think it was regarded as a rather quixotic enterprise, but today it's grown into an international effort that is funded to the tune of many millions of dollars. And there is a real enthusiasm, I think, for continuing the search, sweeping the skies with radio telescopes in the hope of stumbling across a message from ET. So my feeling about the 50th anniversary is, well, 50 years silence so far, maybe it's a good time to take stock, to look back and say, could we be doing something a bit different? Should we broaden the search? Should we be thinking about this problem in a rather different way?
Yes, I see. Now, these millions of dollars worth of funding, that doesn't come from the government, does it?
Absolutely not. It's all privately funded these days. In the past, NASA has spent money on SETI, as we call it, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It spent, I believe, $70 or $80 million over the years. But this funding was stopped in the early 90s, and since then, it's been entirely, in the United States, entirely privately funded. And the lion's share of the funding at the moment is coming from Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft.
I see. Well, it's a vast universe. How much of that universe are we really able to probe to find if there is ET out there?
You're quite right with that question. Only a tiny, tiny fraction. This is a needle in a haystack search without any guarantee that there's even a needle out there. Mm-hmm. And the technique has been to turn radio telescopes on likely nearby stars. And when I say likely, that is stars that seem to be like the sun, that might have planets around them like the Earth, and to go through a catalogue of these stars out to a distance of 100 or 200 light years. That is just our little local galactic neighborhood. Our galaxy, the Milky Way, is 100,000 light years across, mm-hmm. and that's just our galaxy, let alone all the other galaxies. Mm-hmm. And so we've just probed this little local corner, and even that in a very limited way. Of course, they can't spend long on any given star. Mm-hmm. It might be just half an hour.
So this is something on the order of 100,000th of our galaxy that we've been able to probe?
Well, the total number of stars is just over 1,000, I think, a very small number of thousands so far. There are 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. Not all of those are like the sun, but there could well be a trillion Earth-like planets out there in the Milky Way alone. And then there are 100 billion galaxies within the observable universe. Now, the other galaxies are really beyond any hope of us ever picking anything up. But within our own galaxy, we've still only just mm-hmm. scratched that tiny little surface of it.
Mm-hmm. So you say there may be trillions of planets within our galaxy, but how many of them might be habitable?
Well, the key thing here is to distinguish between habitable and inhabited. The total number that might be habitable could be as high as 1 or 2%, so that's still a stupendous number of habitable planets. But the big unknown factor in this is, supposing you've got another Earth out there, what are the chances that life will obligingly form? And nobody knows the answer to that. So during my career, the pendulum has swung from the prevailing opinion being almost never to now almost always. But the scientific facts on the ground haven't changed. One of the curious things about this subject is how it is now okay to talk about ET, whereas 50 years ago was really regarded as tantamount to looking for fairies. And so my main concern as a scientist is, how can we sharpen this up? How can mm-hmm. we get a handle on this big unknown, which is the probability that life will pop up on an Earth-like planet if you've got one? Because we don't know what that number is. It could be a very, very small number, or it could be a number close to one. It could be a near certainty.
Yes, and on that point, you say in your book that science really has no clue about how life evolved on Earth.
Well, I distinguish very sharply between emerged and evolved. We know how life evolves on Earth because we have a theory of evolution. Mm-hmm. A very successful theory. So we have some understanding of the mechanism whereby life can evolve from its humble origins as microbes to the complexity of the biosphere we see today. What we don't have is a theory of how it got started in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Darwin himself said it is mere rubbish to talk about the origin of life. One might as well talk about the origin of matter. So he dismissed that we would ever have a decent theory of life's origin. Well, we still don't 150 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So scientists are pretty much divided into those who think that it's a bizarre chemical fluke that will happen very, very rarely, maybe only once within the observable universe, and those who think that the emergence of life is pretty much written into the laws of physics and will happen more or less on cue, given Earth-like conditions and sufficient time.
Yeah.
And we really don't know where on that spectrum the truth lies. The problem is that on Earth, life began a very long time ago, at least 3.5 billion years ago, and we may never have a blow-by-blow account of the steps that took place. But what we'd really like to know is not so much the specifics of it, but just, was it an easy thing to get started or a very, very difficult thing? We don't know the answer to that basic question.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, it seems that to some extent, saying that we don't understand how life originated is a bit at odds, perhaps, with the mainstream of scientific thought. And I take as an example of that, the editors of the Scientific American in last September's issue said, and I quote, that studies have supported the hypothesis that primitive cells containing molecules similar to RNA could assemble spontaneously, reproduce, and evolve, giving rise to all life. That makes it sound like science has pretty much solved the mystery.
Very far from it. This is the so-called RNA world hypothesis, and it's one possible way that life could get started. Nobody knows where the RNA would come from. There are many of these scenarios and conjectures. One of them might be right, but we simply at this particular time don't know. And the basic problem here is easy to state, that in a fairly simple lab, you can make the building blocks of life, the amino acids and one or two other organic molecules. It's not hard to do that at all. But the simplest living thing we know is so stupendously complex that leaping that gulf is something that is pretty much unknown, that we don't know what the mechanisms were. So what I want to do is to try and come up with a way that we can pin this down. Well, there is one way we can directly test this, and that is to ask, has it happened more than once on Earth? After all, no planet is more Earth-like than Earth itself. So if life really does pop up readily in Earth-like conditions, surely it should have started many times over right here on our home planet. Well, how do we know it didn't? And amazingly enough, until a few years ago, nobody had thought to look. Everybody assumed that all life on Earth was the same life, descended from a common origin. The idea that there could be a different form of life on Earth, that is, life but not as we know it, never really occurred to anyone. Plenty of thought was given to life as we don't know it on Mars or Europa or somewhere else, but no thought to life on Earth as we don't know it. Well, I'm trying to remedy that and trying to encourage people to look for what we call a shadow biosphere, that is, that alongside the regular life that we know and love and recognize, there could be microbial life descended from a separate origin, belonging to a different tree of life altogether, would be alien in the sense of not even being on our own tree of life. If we found two forms of life on Earth, we could be pretty sure it's going to be all around the universe. So that's, I think, the best way of answering this question.
Yeah, that's a very intriguing idea, and I hadn't heard of that before, but it's you go into quite some lengths in that, about that in your book. And you say that the efforts to look for this are just beginning?
That's right. There are one or two programs that have been funded. Part of the problem, of course, is we don't quite know what we're looking for. It's life, but not as we know it. So what is it going to be like? Well, we can make some educated guesses. And so one approach has been to do that and to go look for the way that life might be different. The other way is to think about places on Earth that are beyond the reach of even the hardiest organisms of life as we know it, see if anything's living there.
Mm-hmm.
And the third way is to find some way of disabling or slowing up all known life and then seeing if anything is left standing at the end. And so these three approaches are all being tried in one way or the other, but on a very small scale. This is a very new subject, is a very new set of ideas that I'm trying to put out there. And what I'm hoping is that other scientists will begin to join in this search, because after all, scientists are searching the planet for exotic forms of life anyway, so they might as well keep their eyes open to something that just doesn't fit in
right
to the paradigm of life that we know.
Right. I think one of the things you mentioned in your book is that life could conceivably use arsenic instead of phosphorus.
Yes, that's an idea of my colleague Felisa Wolf-Simon, now working with the U.S. Geological Survey, on the trail of arsenic life. She's looking in Mono Lake in California, which is laced with arsenic. It's a horrible place for you and me, but for an organism which might have arsenic instead of phosphorus in its innards, it would be a sort of paradise. And so she's dredging the lake to see what microorganisms are there and is culturing them in the lab under high arsenic and zero phosphorus conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to see whether this arsenic gets into their biomass, and then if this turns out to be the case, and she's hot on the trail, then the next step would be to see if these are genuinely alternative organisms, and they're not just sort of dealing with the arsenic at arm's length, they're genuinely arsenic organisms. And then the question that comes after that is, are they descendants of a separate genesis, or just a side branch on the known tree of life, some exotic addition to life as we know it.
Mm-hmm. That seems like a debate that might go on for quite a while.
Well, I think we might know very soon whether there are organisms that really are incorporating arsenic into their biomass. But finding those that are sufficiently different, sufficiently weird, that we could say they could not possibly have branched off our known tree of life, that's an argument that could go on for a long while. Because of course, there's an element of judgment there, because one can always say that maybe two different branches of life join up if you go far enough back into the mists of time.
Right. The question is, how weird do you require this new form to be in order to be considered a completely distinct form of life?
Well, I can answer that question by bracketing it. And if, for example, we found a form of life which was pretty much the same as life that we know, but with a slightly different genetic code, then, for my money, that would simply be a hitherto undiscovered branch on the known tree that
mm-hmm.
had split off before the code that we are used to, the universal code in all life so far has been studied, had evolved. But let me give you the opposite extreme. Supposing we found microorganisms with molecules that might be fairly familiar, organic-type molecules, but the mirror images of those that we use. It turns out that all your amino acids and mine are left-handed and all our sugars are right-handed, and that seems to be a universal feature of life that we know. If we found organisms where it was the other way around, it would be very hard to see how they could have had a common origin. And so there's one of the experiments that I'm involved in is looking for this type of mirror life, where the molecules would be the mirror images. Chemistry doesn't care whether it's left or right, but once you make a decision, it's like the rule of the road. You can drive on the left or you can drive on the right. Doesn't matter so long as everyone does the same.
Right.
And that's the way with life. And so if we found mirror life, then I think that would be a clear-cut case of independent origin.
So that mirror life wouldn't be able to digest the food that we do, and
right,
vice versa.
Right, vice versa. So there wouldn't be direct competition, but they could coexist peacefully and be following similar sorts of chemical pathways, but non-overlapping.
You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are talking today with Paul Davies, author of the new book, The Eerie Silence. We'll be right back after these messages. When you're planning a cruise, the best place for comparing prices and itineraries is CruiseDirect.com. You can choose your cruise by destination, cruise line, or budget. CruiseDirect.com is your online destination for cruising.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, GuideToTheCosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's GuideToTheCosmos.com.
We're back, talking to Paul Davies, the author of the new book, The Eerie Silence, about our search for extraterrestrial intelligence. One of the things I enjoyed about your book was the discussion of Enrico Fermi's paradox, which I was particularly fond of because Enrico Fermi was my father's mentor and a very good friend of the family.
Wow.
Yeah.
Enrico Fermi.
My father got his PhD from Enrico Fermi, and Fermi got him a job in the United States, which was a very good thing at the time, right after the end of the Second World War. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what Enrico Fermi thought of E.T.?
Right. Well, the first thing to point out is that Enrico Fermi was the archetypal genius and up among the ranks of Einstein and others as a theoretical physicist of enormous standing with many, many discoveries that underpinned it. And he was involved in the Manhattan atomic bomb project during the Second World War, and stayed on at Los Alamos after the war. And in the early 1950s, there were lots of reports of what people called flying saucers in those days, and some lunchtime discussion took place, and Fermi suddenly piped up with the question, where is everybody? Mm-hmm. And what he meant by this was that Earth has been around 4.5 billion years. There were stars and planets around long before Earth even existed. If aliens were going to come here, there's no particular reason they would leave it until the 1950s. They could have come at any time during Earth's immense history. And so if they're out there, he thought, well, why haven't they come here? If they really are colonizing, expanding alien communities, they should have been here a long, long time ago. The fact that they are not here and hadn't come a long time ago, he thought was evidence that they didn't exist. And so it's sometimes called the Fermi paradox. It's not really a paradox. It's simply an observation that E.T. did not colonize Earth 100 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to consider that scenario a little bit more carefully, because we've got this anthropomorphic idea of humans spreading out of Africa and colonizing the whole planet, and that's the way we do it. But it could well be that alien communities simply don't want to do that. They might well go on expeditions, or they may have colonization waves that come and then they move on. There could be all sorts of reasons why alien beings, or their machines more likely, could have come through the solar system a long time ago. So when Fermi said, where is everybody? Well, maybe they were here, but they've left. And then you have to ask, how long ago? Well, in this game, you've got to think on billion-year timescales. So if we take conservative estimates, 100 million years ago, supposing Earth was visited by aliens 100 million years ago, supposing it was even settled for a time, would we know? Is there anything that would remain after 100 million years of their activity? And the answer is not very much at all. But there are some things, and what I've tried to do in the book is come up with a list of things we might look for.
Mm-hmm.
For example, nuclear waste is something that we might still find even after 100 million years. But there's one particular thing that is close to my heart, which is that one of the industries that we're engaged in at the moment is biotechnology, or synthetic biology. We're creating novel organisms for our own purposes, for purposes of agriculture or mineral processing or environmental management.
Mm-hmm.
It's not inconceivable that aliens coming to Earth 100 million years ago would have done something similar, and we might see a legacy of their biological tampering in the biological record. And then that leads me to an even more fanciful conjecture, which is that rather than E.T. sending us messages in the form of radio waves, which is the conventional way of doing SETI, maybe they uploaded the message into the genomes of terrestrial organisms. After all, the message in the bottle is a very well-known way of leaving something for posterity. You put the message in the bottle, you throw it in the sea, you don't know where it'll go, if anybody will ever find it, or who will ever find it, and you don't expect a reply. It's a one-way message. So maybe E.T. has put a message in a bottle, and the bottle is living cells, and the message is digitally encoded in DNA. So I've got this idea that we should look at the genomes, which are even now being sequenced, of organisms here on Earth, just to see if there might be a message there from a long-vanished alien civilization or visitation. Of course, it's a wild and crazy idea, but is it any crazier than E.T. encoding messages in radio waves? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. And how might you spot that in the genome?
Oh, well, given they're being sequenced anyway, you can download these things from the Internet. You can run them through a computer, and you would look for telltale signs of something standing out.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you had a run of numbers, like the prime numbers, that would make you sit up and take notice. DNA has a four-letter alphabet, so there are different combinations that you could have which might stand out. The difficulties here are that over time the genomes tend to mutate, they drift away. This is all part of the natural process of evolution. And so that's something that would eventually degrade the message. But there are clever ways of getting conserved messages that would piggyback off things that natural selection would tend to preserve. And so I think there's a chance that a message in the genome could last 100 million years, maybe even longer. We've got genes in our bodies which date back 3 billion years, hardly changed at all. That sequence information hasn't changed very much. So there may be a way of doing it, and of providing organisms here on Earth that would then just go on replicating and replicating, preserving that message for stupendous amounts of time.
Now, toward the end of your book, you mentioned that you believe that it's possible that we might be the only intelligent form of life in the galaxy, or even in the entire observable universe. Would you like to tell us why you think that?
Right. It goes right back to this discussion we had a little earlier about the chances that life will form on another Earth if you've got one. There are undoubtedly many other Earths out there, but we just can't put a figure on how likely it is that life will emerge. Now, if it turns out that the first living cell on Earth formed by the shuffling of molecules randomly falling into place by accident, then obviously this is such an improbable event that it will have occurred only once in the entire observable universe.
Mm-hmm.
And even if life did get going elsewhere, there are a host of other factors which determine whether or not intelligence is going to emerge, whether science is going to emerge, and all of these other things that lead up to trying to put a number to the communicating civilizations that are out there. We must be alive to the fact that it could have been just one long series of lucky accidents here on Earth leading to us. We're asking the questions only because these accidents have happened. You can't infer from the fact that there was this sequence of accidents that it was bound to occur. And so we could be alone in the universe. I find that personally a rather depressing prospect. But at the mm-hmm. present state of our ignorance, we can't be sure there's any life beyond Earth, let alone intelligent life. And so as a scientist, I must say that until I see some pretty strong evidence in favor of intelligent life, I've got to remain a skeptic. But as a human being, I do passionately believe and would like to believe anyway that the universe is teeming with life and that there are lots of ETs out there and that some of them might be trying to attract our attention. I really hope that is the case.
Yes, indeed. Well, certainly the discovery of extraterrestrial life would be one of the most monumental discoveries in the history of science. But if we could go even a step further and communicate with extraterrestrial intelligence, and imagine we could ask them just one question. What question would you ask?
Well, here I show my true colors, because I think that the cultural differences between human beings on this planet are so great that we continually have misunderstandings. You only need to open the newspaper. And so if we try to imagine bridging the gulf between ourselves and a completely different species, then it's very hard to imagine that there would be much in common. I'm sure they wouldn't share our sense of humor or love of sport, for example. But there are some things that we do have in common, and one of these is mathematics and the laws of physics, because these are universal, and if they're communicating with us, they must know about this. And so I think the most fertile ground for asking questions is in this realm of mathematics and physics. And as a theoretical physicist, of course, there are a number of very deep puzzles about the nature of the physical universe that keep me awake at night and have done throughout my entire career. There's one particular thing having to do with some of the fundamental constants of nature, and I won't get too technical here, but in the realm of quantum electrodynamics, there's some famous unexplained puzzles about that, and I think I would just love to have the answer to that. And also, quantum physics and gravitation are notoriously difficult to marry together in a harmonious way mathematically, and I think if ET has got that problem cracked, I would really like to know about it. So for me, it's in the realm of what my professional career has been. But I'm sure other people would have completely different things to ask this wise entity in the sky.
Mm-hmm. And if we could tell them just one thing about us, what would you tell them?
I think about what on earth would they make of our civilization. And some people think, well, a Beethoven symphony or a Picasso painting or something might represent the pinnacle of human intellectual achievement. And that may be the case, but I'm not sure how much they would appreciate it. But I really do think they would appreciate some of our scientific triumphs. And there are many. I think one of the things that is most remarkable about this species, Homo sapiens, is that over the last 200 or 300 years, we've not only come to observe the universe in ever greater detail, but we've come to understand it through science and mathematics, through our theories of fundamental physics. And so I think that's what we're most proud of, and so we should not only ask them questions about how to solve some of those great issues in theoretical physics, but tell them about some of the solutions that we've managed to discover.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very one-dimensional view, and I'm sure mm-hmm. many listeners will be disappointed and think, well, that's not much of an answer. It's just the sort of thing a theoretical physicist would say, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. but as you say, they would understand math and physics. They wouldn't
right.
understand Beethoven necessarily. Any last things you want to say about ET?
Well, my feeling about ET is that it addresses an issue which goes back to the dawn of history, which is, are we alone in the universe? And everybody on this planet must have pondered that question. Whenever I go to dinner parties, mention I'm a scientist, it comes up inevitably in conversation. And you may think this is a needle in a haystack search without any guarantee that there's a needle out there. But it's a search worth doing, if only because it forces us to have these interesting discussions like we're having now, which is, what is life? What is intelligence? What is the destiny of mankind? What is our place in the universe? These are good, healthy things to think about. And if for no other reason that it forces us to address those questions, I think SETI is worth doing. And so it has my strong backing, and I just hope we can do it better and in different ways in future.
Well, that's wonderful. So your new book, The Eerie Silence, is being published as of today, I understand.
I believe it is today.
Yes, and great. So where can people find this book?
Well, in the well-known phrase, in every good bookstore, or of course always Amazon.
Okay, again, the title is The Eerie Silence by Paul Davies, and I think it's a wonderful book. It covers everything that we talked about today and a lot more, and it's certainly gives us lots of food for thought. So, Paul, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Robert, it's been my pleasure, and I thank you for your great interest in this subject.
Well, and very good luck on your book, sir.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in. And remember, you are never too old or too young to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.